Welcome to Two-Way Street. You may remember that a few weeks ago, a security robot called the K5 Autonomous Data Machine made headlines around the world when it tripped, fell, and essentially drowned in a fountain while patrolling a mall in Washington, D.C. Social media lit up with jokes about K5. One guy tweeted, "We were promised flying cars, instead we got suicidal robots." Your reaction to K5's plunge may depend on how you think about robots. Do you want robots to keep learning new skills so they can take over, say, cleaning your house or giving your 7-year-old her bath? Or are you nervous that a robot may well push you out of your job? Or, worst case scenario, are you convinced that robots may eventually try to take over the world, like they did in Terminator 3, War of the Machines, and about a million other science fiction movies and books? Our guest today, Georgia Tech Associate Professor Ayanna Howard, understands all of those responses to robots, but she says that, like it or not, they're going to become more and more ubiquitous in our daily lives. That's fine with her. Dr. Howard has devoted her career to designing and building smarter and ever more capable robots. She worked at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, where she helped develop software that allowed the Mars rover to navigate the Martian surface by thinking about the challenges the way a human would. Later, she created a robot called the Snowmote. It was designed to study the impact of global warming on the ice shelves of Antarctica. A couple of years ago, Dr. Howard was named by Business Insider as one of the 23 most powerful female engineers in the world. She's been written up by Time Magazine, USA Today, and a number of other publications. But when she sat down in the Two-Way Street studio for our conversation, I started by asking her about a label she'd once given herself. You call yourself a blurred. B-L-E-R-D. What exactly is a blurred?
It's a black nerd, basically. And I also call myself a geek, but it's basically, deep down, there's this cultural aspect because I'm African American growing up here, but I'm also truly a geek. I love computer science and techie stuff and all those things that are typically classified as nerd.
Your interest really began pretty early. One of your favorite TV shows was
The Bionic Woman. And I watched the show and I thought, oh, that's so fascinating.
What was The Bionic Woman for listeners who don't remember?
So The Bionic Woman was this woman, and she was in a terrible, terrible accident. So they repaired her with bionic parts. And instead of being frustrated and angry, she took that on and basically had social causes. So I just say she saved the world with her bionics.
What's fascinating to me, and we're going to talk about it later, is that among your many interests in robotics is exoskeletons, which in many ways are the bionic man and woman brought to new life in the 21st century.
That is true.
You went to work at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and I want to talk about one of the projects you worked on.
So I was involved with a project called SmartNav, which was in between Pathfinder and MER, Mars Exploration Rover. So my job at NASA was to think of ways of getting our rovers to be more intelligent when they were navigating Mars. So I was a researcher. My sponsor was Mars Exploration Program. And so it was thinking outside of the box. So this was after Sojourner, basically, where we had a very highly, highly engineered robot that went to Mars, and the decisions it made were very basic. If I come to a rock, I choose left or right, kind of, I won't say flip a coin, but very close to that. And the idea was, how do we do things like over the line horizon? If I'm on Mars and I see what's out there, that's one thing, but what's over the horizon? Can I figure out how to navigate to someplace I can't see? What does that look like? So my task was to try to figure out how people do it, scientists, and translate that to make our robots smarter.
As you deal with robotics, it's important to you to translate how people deal with a given situation to the robot itself. And that's what you did in this case. You've done that your whole career, yes?
I have. And one of the reasons is the robots, the reason they're special versus, say, you know, computers or tablets or smartphones is that robots are the closest to an emulation of us. And it's also why we're also so terrified of them. When we think about robotic systems, we really think of them as part of our society, as playmates and healthcare workers and possibly workers that are working alongside us in the manufacturing environment. That's a different place than any other technology. And early on, I was of the camp where I wasn't designing robots to take people's jobs. And that was always, even back then when robots really weren't, that was a fear. Like, oh, robots, you're working in a space, you're going to take my job. My philosophy has always been that technology does replace jobs, but robots, the benefits are so positive. And I wanted to be in the camp that was working on the benefits, which meant figuring out how people did things and working with people in order to make their lives better.
And when you worked on that rover exercise, you said in one interview, and I'm quoting you now, that was the turning point. The best way to design the next generation of robots is not just program and design them from scratch, but look at the experts already, which are people. We've evolved into these creatures that we are, and we typically want them, meaning the robots, to do something we already can do. And that was a big revelation for you.
That's a really good quote.
Okay. You've said at one point that we have to redefine what we think of when we talk about a robot. So let's talk about robots in a variety of ways. We interact with robots, I think, more than we realize we do. Right. So, for instance, a car that now parks itself, that's really a robot or it's robotic technology.
I agree. I think so. One of the things is the term robot is a moving target now. The things that we have in instances of time, they are robotic systems. For example, a car that's parking itself. It's sensing the environment. It's making decisions. It has actions. In that moment of time, there's no difference between it and a fully autonomous robotic system in that instance of time. I would even argue things like some wheelchairs that have some automation in them that can actually navigate. So there's some wheelchairs now that have mini navigation systems if they see an obstacle. In that instance of time, they are functioning like a robotic system. But we don't call them robotics. We call it a car. We call it a wheelchair. We'll call it a washing machine. We don't even add in the robotic system unless you're marketing, and then everything is a robotic system. You know, robotic vacuum cleaner, robotic washing machine. But it's a moving target. And as we include things that have been developed because of robotics, so a lot of things in vision processing, the reasoning was because we wanted systems that could be autonomous. And so we had to
proceed. What do you mean vision processing?
So things such as... if I look at some of these systems that fly, drones as an example, and they're looking at the environment and they're looking at the terrain and they're trying to identify things like buildings and all of these aspects. If you look at where that information came from, like where did that technology come from, you can see that down the line somewhere there was someone in robotics who was working on a problem that was core robotics and this was a derivative. And so there's a lot of these components that are out there that were a derivative of things that were done in the robotics and AI world long time ago that are now having life as components.
So if we have to look for a new definition of robots, how do you define robots?
So I think where we are trying to move when people think about robotic systems, they really think of the Rosie of the future. That's really what they think of now when they're thinking of someone like Terminator 2, even though that's not where I'm at. They're thinking of Chappie, if you remember that movie. I won't comment on the movie. But they're thinking of that, but that is not the core definition of a robotic system.
When you say those things, you're talking about the robot that looks like a C-3PO, a version of a human being in some ways, but made out of metal or, you know.
Made out of metal. It can manipulate, so it has some semblance of arms, may not have legs, doesn't necessarily have legs, but it can work in our human environments as if they were almost human.
But you're saying that's not how you think of robots.
I don't. I think that when you think about robotics, I consider some of these robotic components, I consider them robotic systems. Maybe people would disagree with me because they have all of the flavoring which we define, which is this whole sensing, thinking, and acting. I think I would start adding in interaction now. I think now robots should be defined based on their interaction with people. I think we're moving toward that, where one of the definitions will be, yeah, it can sense the environment, it can make decisions, and it can act, but it also has to interact with people in some form or fashion. I think that's starting to be added into our concept and definition of a robotic system as well.
You've said that there are several rules that we have to keep in mind when we look at how robots are going to be built and used. What are the three rules?
So, and I didn't make these up. So Isaac Asimov had these, it started off with three and it was expanded over the years.
Isaac Asimov being the great science fiction writer.
Yes. And I think that, in fact, there was a movie, iRobot, that was based on kind of incarnation of these rules. But basically, the rules at the end of the day is, you know, you will obey the commands of your human. You will not harm, i.e. the human, and you will protect yourself and the human. But there's so many ways of violating that. You know, if we design a robot peacekeeper, for example, its function is to keep the peace. But as we know, if you're a peacekeeper, part of that is basically adding in constraints to bad people. So therefore, you're now obeying your commands, but you're harming a human. So you've just violated one of the rules. And so there's a lot of issues on making this a reality in terms of the rules. But I think at the end, the philosophy is designing robots so that when you look at the pros and cons, the pros on impact, positive impact to society outweighs the negatives.
Those rules are there for a designer like yourself to follow as you program a robot.
Correct. And then that also means that you have to have a programmer that's ethical.
Well, ethical and moral.
Right. And I, you know, just like there's bad people in the world, there's scientists who value robotics for the technology itself, not necessarily for the harm that it can have. So I won't say that's a an ethical issue. Is just I love the technology so much. And then you look, you're like, oh my gosh, you just used my technology for bad. I don't think you think about that at the beginning. A lot of scientists don't. But we're training our roboticists, at least our students now, to think a little bit more about the ethical considerations when they are designing software or a platform. Like, okay, you're designing this, but what are the implications of this system, you know, in terms of, you know, is it going to be a trustworthy system? Is it going to have bias? Is it going to harm someone? Is it going to take away jobs? And maybe the answer is yes to all of that. But then what are the positives? What are you replacing? If you're taking a job away, well, are you then creating the possibility of quality of life, enhanced quality of life? And so we're starting to teach our students to think a little bit more intelligently about the social implications of the robotic systems they're designing and building.
I do want to get a better sense of what your robots look like. You've said that it's a stereotype, essentially, to think of robots as looking like a C-3PO having arms and a face and all that.
Well, actually, my robots are human.
Yes, because you have said on a number of occasions that one of your goals is to make robots that look more human-like.
At least in terms of their actions and their behaviors. Legs, they can have wheels or legs, but they have to have the upper torso. They have to manipulate. Our environment is full of objects that we need to interact with. So our robots have to have some form of manipulation. And if I have created these devices in my environment to grab, it's because I have a human hand. So my robot kind of has to emulate if it wants to interact with the same objects in my environment. And so those are the simulations. I think the behaviors are very important because we as people, we do a lot of prediction. When I interact with another person, I make a model of them. I anticipate things about them because I have a norm about behavior. So if I wave and say hi to you, I kind of expect you to wave back. And if you don't, then I start thinking, maybe they're mad at me. Maybe they didn't see me. So then I put in all of this information because I expect you to have a certain behavior.
Is that complicated? Is that hard to teach the robot to do that?
So to do that one thing, no.
But it involves a number of different systems. First of all, the robot must see
the person.
And there must be a program that identifies a gesture.
Right. Which we have. Correct.
Okay. But then it's got to respond to the gesture, and that's a whole different.
Right. So that's the part of these social norms, which is the hard part. So the vision processing, like the gesture recognition.
Easy.
We've done. We now have systems
easy
that
peasy.
Do this. I won't say easy, but we have systems that do this. But the question is if I do recognize something, I recognize a person that's waving. Say I recognize a person that looks, quote unquote, depressed or sad. What is my response? That is the hard part because that response has so many connotations. If I see someone who's sad, right, my response might be I need to make them happy. But maybe they're sad because they just found out someone passed away. Well, happy is not the right response for that. At that point, you are supposed to empathize and say, oh, I understand your pain. But if they're sad because they got a F on their report card, then you're like, oh, we could do better. I owe it to that teacher. It's a different response if you know the reason why they have something like a sad. That's hard. We have many, many years of experience. It's why kids typically don't have the right responses, i.e. when someone's outside and someone trips and falls. I'm going to tell you, a five-year-old will chuckle a little bit just because they see something. And then unless they have a reinforcement of, oh, that's not appropriate, you're not supposed to laugh when someone's in pain, that's a learned response.
Have you gotten to a point where you're teaching robots to be able to perceive that sort of thing?
I am. Again, we're not talking generalization. We look at how people interact with each other in certain situations, and we're mimicking that. Again, it's based on the data. It's limited by what the robot can
see. Yes, but if a robot sees me and I'm crying, I have tears in my eyes. Mm-hmm. Are you suggesting that robot can process the tears and make a decision that I am sad and respond to that?
So sad, yeah. So there are now emotion recognition systems. Example, Effectiva has one, Microsoft has one, where they are able to recognize emotions. It's actually pretty accurate.
There are people who can't recognize the emotions in other people, Ayana.
And some of these systems are being used to train people as well.
So let's go back to the robot who's going to wave back at you.
Okay.
So one example is the human actually waves, and the robot knows how to wave back. He processes that and says, oh, I'm going to be friendly, I'll wave back. But if the human actually has a gun in her hand and is waving it to suggest that the robot better be careful because I'm threatening him, the robot can recognize that?
If it has not been trained, no. So that's the one issue is you have to have the data.
So you train it how to recognize a gun and what the meaning of a gun is.
No, you would actually recognize. So if you think about the behavior and the body language of someone who's having a gun, it's not just the hand wave. It's a lot of other things. And in fact, if you think about a hand and I'm waving a gun, usually my posture is much more intimidating. I kind of lift myself up because I puff out my chest because I want this aggression. Your body shifts versus when you're happy. There's actually a difference in how your structure and your posture changes. So that has to be part of the learning.
We're going to take a break right now. When we come back, more about robots with Dr. Ayana Howard. We'll be right back. If you're just joining us, we're talking today about robots, about artificial intelligence, and about a future in which humans and machines may work together more closely than ever before. My guest is Dr. Ayanna Howard. She's an associate professor of electrical and computer engineering at Georgia Tech, where she continues her long career developing smarter and ever more capable robots. We've talked in really interesting generalities and hypotheticals, I understand. I think it'd be terrific if we go down to the next level with you, and let's talk about how you have been training robots in very specific ways. You're particularly interested in how robots can be used for people who have disabilities, who have illnesses, they need monitoring, they need therapy, physical therapy perhaps. Talk about the work you're doing in that area.
So we're designing robots to be therapy coaches. So in the clinical world, there's two types of therapy. There's this contact-based, so I might touch your body, touch your hand, and show you a movement of what I want you to do. And then there's this non-contact, which is I've taught you what I want you to do, and then I give you verbal feedback, I give you corrective feedback, I give you motivational feedback. Like, okay, let's do what I just showed you how to do. You know, move your hand to the block. Maybe move it to the left, go a little faster. Great job. Let's try that again. So there's that aspect. So that's the part we're mimicking, is that interactive part, non-contact based in terms
of. So that would be if I have had an injury of some sort and I need physical therapy, but there aren't enough human physical therapists available on a regular basis to give me what I need.
Well, and the fact is there aren't. So if you look at the amount of physical therapy that you are allowed even with good insurance, it is not enough to achieve the outcomes that you deserve, honestly. And so if you're of means, you can have the therapy, a human therapist every day. Actually, that's the best. But of course, most people aren't at that level. And so what do you do when you're in the home? So maybe you can go see your therapist once a week. What happens in the meantime? You're at home. And as you know, exercise is the one thing that people just have a problem with getting motivated. You're like, yes. So day one after therapy, you're like, yes, I'm going to do my exercise. And day two, you're like, oh, I'm kind of tired. Maybe I'll just do half of it. And by day three, you're like, oh, I'll see the therapist next week. That's just human nature. So imagine that you have someone who's, I would say nagging, but someone in your home, robotic therapist, where you're like, oh, I'm just tired. And your robot says, oh, wait, hold it. 5 o'clock, we're supposed to do therapy. And robot says, hey, let's play. Let's do a game. Let's do our exercise. What we found is that, and we focus on children with special needs, we've done these studies, is that children will do their exercise when the robot is present. That's what we want. And so that's what the robot's job is.
What does that robot look like?
So I'll talk about the Darwin robot, because that'll be the easiest. Okay, so Darwin is about 18 inches high. Humanoid robot. It's has a black grayish skin, metal. It has eyes that light up, which we can change based on emotion. It has a head, so it can turn its head. It has arms and it has legs. And so it has the actuation, the motors, to simulate the same kind of gestures people have, like waving and standing and kicking a red ball. Yes, yes. So Darwin does exhibit emotions. It recognizes a child's emotional state, limited emotional state, happy, frustration, sadness, things like that, and responds accordingly based on what they're doing in terms of therapy. And so if a child, for example, is quote unquote winning a therapy game, the robot responds with, you know, great job, let's go. And the gestures are like, if you think about a game and you just had a touchdown, it's like, awesome, and you pull your hand down. So we have those kind of things with the awesome, but it's a robotic voice, so it's not a awesome human voice, but awesome as robots say awesome. And so it does do that emotional interaction, that trying to establish an emotional bond with the kid.
One of the exciting things I know that you've been interested in, being able to have robots or robotic parts that can feel texture.
So my thesis was about how do you create robots that could manipulate objects in a hospital? So things, everything from bags of sheets from the beds to things like syringes and needles. And one of the things, if you look at how people do it, there's this aspect of you lift things. But there's something about a texture. When I pick up a pillow versus I pick up a glass versus an egg, I use information about the surface and the texture as well as the weight to figure out how I should grab this. I mean, it's very rare that a person will grab an egg too hard, right? Why is this? And yet a pillow, if you think about how you pick up a pillow, you usually grab a pillow pretty hard. I mean, if you think about grasping. So how's it that we differentiate and yet those two weights are probably equivalent? A lot of it is about the surface and how the object feels when we hold it and how it slips and things like that. And so early on in my thesis, I looked at that. And so I'm still very much interested in that in terms of being able to manipulate things in our environment.
But that's a breakthrough area yet to come, but an exciting one, yes?
It's very exciting. And I'm seeing things in the research domain that seems to be making that much closer to a reality.
Okay. Can we talk about the future for a few minutes? Should I have a personal robot, and will I have one in 10 years, and will all of my friends have personal robots?
Yes, I think you should have a personal robot.
What will that robot look like?
Will you have it in 10 years? No. What will that robot look like?
I mean, I assume there are going to be a variety of robots, but they're going to be humanoid in some ways, yes or no?
I honestly think, in terms of the future, I think there's going to be a trajectory. I think the first thing we're going to see are specialized robots that do very specific tasks. So it might be that I have a kitchen robot, and my kitchen robot is one that clears the table and puts dishes up and washes dishes or puts the dishes in the dishwasher. So very specific. Don't ask it to go into the bathroom because it will fail. So very, very specific. And then you'll have a robot that might actually be the one that goes around the house picking up things from the floor and putting it up. So very, very specific. I think those are going to be the first type of robots that we see. We're seeing it now. I mean, if you think about, there's the lawnmower robot, very specific task. It mows the lawn. You have the vacuum cleaner, very specific task. So I think there's actually a laundry folding robot that just came out. Very specific, which is laundry folding, and it's for, which I did not know, hotels spend an awful amount of time folding sheets. Very labor intensive. And so there's a company that's building this laundry folding robot that basically just folds sheets. That's what we're going to see in the near term. I think what happens is when these systems finally get into people's homes, then you're going to see this drastic improvement because you're going to start bringing things together to take, okay, why is it that my kitchen robot can't go pick up things in the house? Okay, why is there a disconnect? Okay, let's figure this out. Let's combine these functions. You know, why is it that my robot that vacuums the floor can't now pick up the items on the floor and do my dishes? And so I think what you're going to start seeing is these specialized robots is going to converge to having your personalized individual robot, as I say, the Rosie of the house.
Yeah. I said 10 years from now, but it's longer than that.
Yeah. So the 10 years I see in terms of
specialized.
Certain things are going to be easy to solve. Other things are going to be harder. So 10 years, I can see you going to the store and being able to purchase something that doesn't cost the price of a car.
We will want them to look at like somewhat like humans, won't we? Or do we? What's your experience as you talk to people about this? Would they rather have something that looks like a machine so they don't get a little bit freaked out? Or do they want a humanoid to relate to?
So they have done enough studies, and they call it the uncanny valley. There's been enough studies done by other researchers that has shown that we want someone or a robot that mimics our appearance, but doesn't really look like us. For novelty, for, you know, entertainment, for theme parks, that's fine. But in our day-to-day lives that we interact on a consistent basis, we don't want them looking exactly like us because there's some disconnect between how they move and how they behave and what we expect. I always say, like, the living zombie. if a person that was dead suddenly came up and started walking, you would be freaked, even though this person was alive before, because it just doesn't feel right. Same thing. And they've shown that robots that look too close to being human give us that kind of uncomfortable feeling. But that's also a moving target.
So let me ask you a philosophical question.
Okay.
You told us before about the rules for making a robot.
Right.
Don't do any harm to humans, what the other rules as well. Is there an ethic that goes the other way? Can a human who has a robot at home abuse that robot, that machine, or is that absurd because it's a machine?
I would say it is not absurd. I think that absolutely not. A human does not have the right. And it's not, and I've been asked this question, it's not about the robot. It's not because the robot is conscious. It's a reflection of us as a person, of us as a society. It's just like if you think about animals. If you ask someone and said, oh, is it okay to starve an animal? People would say no. But it's like, wait, the animal doesn't vote, doesn't pay taxes. It's an animal. In fact, I went to the pound and I paid money.
Yes, but an animal has feelings. An animal feels pain. An animal would feel starvation, whereas a robot is basically a machine.
Yeah, but if you see, I'll go with this. If you see a child pulling the legs off a cockroach, people would say, oh, that's not a good thing. I would claim that cockroaches, even though they're living creatures, I don't know if they have found that they have an emotional aspect.
All right, so I love your answer because the robot can't feel anything. The robot cannot be overworked. I suppose the robot could blow a circuit through overwork, but it wouldn't be it wouldn't affect them in terms of any feelings or any exasperation. They don't have any of that. But you made a really important point. To abuse a robot is to place yourself as a human in a murky area of sadism, of excessive behavior, aggression. So in a way, the robot is sort of creating a challenge for who you are as a human being.
It does. And I actually think that's an open question. There's been a lot of discussion about robots and their rights because of this. And questions about, you know, if I, as a programmer, am programming things like emotions and emotional bonds between humans and robots, and robots that can think. So right now, you had asked about the thinking question. But at some point, these robots will be able to learn new knowledge. That's a given.
Which is what artificial intelligence is.
Exactly. So artificial intelligence within the robot brain, that's going to happen. That's a given. So if you have all of these components, then the question is, why is that not a conscious being? And then you go, well, because it's not. Why? And if you look at the definition of how we define consciousness, it's like, well, it's knowledge of self. The robot can have knowledge of self. And so I think when we talk about these things about do robots have rights and is it okay to kick, I think we're really talking about what is it to be human and empathetic and a good human.
Well, you've now, though, added another layer to this question. If artificial intelligence is going to get increasingly sophisticated and a human being abuses a robot and the robot is capable of learning behavior, then, in fact, you can train a robot to violate one of its most basic rules, which is to do no harm to humans.
Right, which is why these rules are like really crazy and they really don't make that much sense anymore. Yes, because you will have people, I'm sure. In fact, I was talking about Chappie. If you remember, that's actually what happened. They taught him bad behavior.
Let's take another break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with robotics expert Dr. Ayanna Howard. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nygut. My guest today is Dr. Ayanna Howard. She's an associate professor of electrical and computer engineering at Georgia Tech. She's been named one of the most powerful women engineers in the world by Business Insider. We're talking today about robots. Can a robot be creative? You can program a robot to play musical sounds. But can you program a robot to compose music?
I would argue yes, because I've actually seen it and heard it. But I know that for an untrained musician, it sounds beautiful. Like, this sounds creative, it sounds new, it sounds unique. If you talk to a trained musician, they will say, no, it's a little shallow.
Well, I'm sure, I wouldn't be surprised by that. But I think I'm going in a somewhat different direction, which is, can you program creativity? And because, sure, I understand that a robot can probably produce random series of notes that may sound to some people like a song, for instance. But creativity comes out of our souls, our emotions, our feelings. Can you program a machine to be creative?
I would argue yes. And it's only because this concept of creativity, which is linked to imagination, which is linked to thinking beyond your own experience level at the end of the day. It's basically thinking based on something that you don't really have a connection with outside of the box. How is that much different than having something like a neural network and just adding random noise so that it jumps and learns something that it wasn't trained to do? And if you think about how we do creativity, isn't it our brain and our minds? And there might be some passion, but I don't know. I find there's some creative people who aren't that passionate, but create beautiful things, and some very passionate people that I would say, well, they think they're creative.
Okay. The headline of the piece that you were interviewed for in the New York Times a couple of years ago, I think, was Don't Be Afraid of Robots, says Ayanna Howard. Why shouldn't we be afraid of robots? If there are legitimate concerns that robots can take over some of the jobs that people have out there. But you don't think that should really be something we worry about. Tell us why we shouldn't be afraid of robots.
Yeah, and I don't think it's we shouldn't be afraid of. We should be conscious of it. We should be concerned. We do need to do things to make sure that society is still better off after the fact. So there are things we need to do. But I think as long as we do these things, I think that things will be okay. And why I say this, and this is actually a big topic of debate. So one thing is, if you look at in general in the past, there's always been a disruptive technology. I mean, back from, you know, the seamstresses and onward. So when you had the loom, you know, people were out of jobs and, you know, it took years before they recovered. But yet, as a whole, they would argue that society was much better off. And you think about the Industrial Revolution, people were put out of work. But if you look at, you know, plus 5 or 10 years, society as a whole was better off. And so I truly believe that robotics is the same. People will, for certain jobs, robots will replace them. But I think, one, that there will be new jobs that we can't imagine. I mean, who knew that you could go to Silicon Valley 20 years ago and make what you make? Who could have written that prescription, right? So there's going to be jobs that we can't even imagine. Maybe it's the robot mechanic. Maybe it's the robot lovemaker. It could be the robot psychiatrist. Like, there needs to be a psychiatrist because the robots are emotionally connected and their kids left them home. I mean, we have no clue what type of jobs are going to be created.
The more existential fear, of course, is that robots will take over the world. Is it possible for robots to grow in intellect, in emotion, in which would include hostility, fear, anger, to a point where they could be threatening to humans?
You know, so I've thought about this. And so I think that it's this counter. So can robots grow to have these emotions and basically have things like, I don't like people, I think so, but I think there's a counter because there's always a yin-yang. For love, there's hate. And in order for you to not like people means that there's a whole nother AI system that loves people. In fact, one said, well, you know what? We'll just have the AIs go to war among themselves because you'll have the AIs for humanity and the AIs against humanity because that's the way it's going to just grow.
Well, all right, then let me scale back the fear. Maybe robots won't take over the world because of what you're saying. But on the other hand, what you've just suggested is you do think it's possible for some robots to develop through artificial intelligence a hostility towards humans and perhaps aggressive and violent behavior
I think it's because there're still bad people in the world. Honestly, I think it's because of us. It's not that they're going to learn to not like us. It's going to be because there's a human that doesn't like us, like themselves, that teaches the robot. And that's just, unfortunately, that's how we are as people. And I think there is a fear that we are going to translate that, or a small group of people will translate that to their robot partners. I mean, we see that now, any technology. Smartphones are being used by bad people. Internet is being used by bad people. Robots is another technology. It will be used by bad people. Hopefully there's enough good people like us that will counter that.
Yeah, the difference is that human beings will die. Robots can go on, for great, great lengths of time being evil. okay, just a couple other quick questions.
All right.
50 years from now,
okay,
will the world be populated by robots living side by side, working side by side with people? Will we see them by the hundreds in our everyday life as we go to work and come home? Will they be all around us? Is that a world you envision? Or will there still be sort of a limited place that robots will occupy? And I'm talking about the humanoid kind of robot.
Right. You know, I would, and I'm going to make a big guess because I will still be alive, hopefully, 50 years from now. I'm going to say yes. And I only say that because if I just look 50 years ago, right, and then I go back 50 years from that, there is no way people if you think about 50 years from now, like 1960, could people have imagined what our world looks like now? No, there's no way they imagined that, except maybe there's archaic writers somewhere that imagined this world, but not really. And so, but if you look at some of the science fiction and you look at some of the amazing things about future worlds, these things were happening, but they were like totally science fiction, like in another galaxy kind of thing. And so if you look at some of the writings of authors now, and you look and see what they're saying even 10 or 20 years ago, it's like, oh, some of this stuff is coming true. What else did they say? Driving, self-driving cars in the air. I just saw a startup that was doing that. Who could have imagined? So I would say yes, 50 years, I can see having a robot caretaker because I'll be that old. I'll need someone in my home so I can stay in my home taking care of me.
Okay, what's your big, big breakthrough dream project?
My big breakthrough is actually dealing with the intelligence. I would love to have what you would call a fresh robot mind, i.e. untrained. Maybe it knows the basics like, you know, perception, vision recognition, things like that, but that it can grow to learn all of my preferences. So basically it understands me and my own personal beliefs and all those things that make my life difficult, like schedules and driving, as part of my life. But it has to learn me.
Go to the library and get me a book, and you have taught it, or it has learned what kind of books you like, for example.
Yes, yes.
That doesn't seem like such a... That doesn't seem like a far out of reach technological thing to accomplish. Yeah,
it's definitely not. I can see this. I mean, if you think about the ideal world, imagine if you think about it, it's all the components. It's the automated refrigerator and all these things. And so I ran out of coffee, and I didn't realize I ran out of coffee. Right. So my refrigerator talks to my autonomous car and says, guess what? She's out of coffee. She's about to wake up for an hour. It goes and drives at the grocery store. There's this robot, basically shopkeeper, that then communicates and says, here's your coffee. And it comes in. And when I wake up, I didn't even know that my coffee had been gone.
I thought that's what teenage children were for.
Yeah.
Ayanna Howard, it's really fun to talk to you. I think the technology, of course, is interesting, but the philosophical questions are so compelling. And I'm really delighted that you are so good at talking about both. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for inviting me.
If you want to learn more about Ayanna Howard and see a few of the links to robot news aggregating sites that we used in researching today's show, check out the Two-Way Street website at gpb.org/TWS or go to our Facebook page and like us while you're there. Here's a footnote to today's conversation. Remember at the top of the show, I told you about all of the jokes that circulated on social media about that security robot that tripped, fell into a fountain, and drowned while patrolling a mall in Washington, D.C.? Well, maybe the robots are getting the last laugh.
Alas, it seems we've got a few more years before the robots take over. A security robot created by the company Netscope was patrolling an office complex in Washington, D.C., when it rolled into a fountain and met its untimely demise on Monday. The incident went viral on Twitter after Bill Faruqui, an employee at the Washington Harbor Complex, tweeted a photo of the 300-pound android, writing, "We were promised flying cars, instead we got suicidal robots." A security robot created by the company Netscope was patrolling an office complex in Washington, D.C., when it rolled into a fountain and met its untimely demise. The K5 robot, which measures about 5 feet tall, is billed as an autonomous presence that is rented out to malls, office buildings, and parking lots to enforce order. The K5 robot, which measures about 5 feet tall, is rented out to malls, office buildings, and parking lots to enforce order with a built-in video camera, license plate recognition, and thermal imaging. Billed as an autonomous presence that can guide itself through even the most complex environments, the robot spins around and whistles. It appears the drudgery became too much on Monday when the robot rolled down some stairs and fell into the fountain. Employees were pictured hauling the robot out of the water, and Netscope said it would deliver a new robot to the office building for free. After Faruqui posted a photo of the robot partially submerged, Twitter users went wild over the image. Guillermo Meneses shared a previous photo of himself standing next to the robot, joking, "My remembrance moment with Steve the robot. Just last Friday. We were such good friends. He looked so happy and healthy."
That's right. I found that on the web. It's a news bot reading the story about the drowned security bot. I'm really not sure where these bot news readers come from, but I run across them every now and then when searching for news on the internet. Maybe you do too. I do know this. The Washington Post now uses an automated news writing system called Heliograph to generate news stories for the paper's website. There's not a robot sitting at a computer churning out copy for the Post. Heliograph is a computer. It's one of a number of automated content generating systems that use artificial intelligence to write stories. Post editors say that as Heliograph learns, it's been turning out stories of ever-increasing insight and depth. The Post experimented with Heliograph to generate sports stories during the Rio Olympics, and that trial run was so successful that the newspaper used the system to write stories on nearly 500 House, Senate, and gubernatorial races in all 50 states. And that was successful, too. Heliograph and similar systems aren't about to replace human journalists anytime soon, but who knows? Maybe someday Two-Way Street will feature an interviewer named, I don't know, XBOTBN3. That's about it for today's Two-Way Street. Remember, if you can't be with us when we're on the air, you can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And all of our shows are archived on our website at gpb.org/TWS. Our senior producer is Jenny Amond. Our producer is Lisa Clark. Our associate producer is Olivia Rheingold. And our engineer is Tyler Morris. I'm Bill Nygut. Hope to see you again next week for another Two-Way Street.